This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, no matter where they may dwell upon the earth. Today, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to continue my audio book, and I'm not going to give you too much commentary on the world's events. Of course, George Bush has recently admitted now CIA secret prisons. And ostensibly, these prisons have been located in the old KGB dungeons of Eastern Europe. Yes, the neocons, which are at root Trotskyites, and that's a fact. Leo Strauss and most of the so-called neocons were originally Trotskyite communists, believe it or not, until they found a better way to promote their illegitimate view toward the world and history. They've become, quote, conservative Republicans. But if you look at their agenda, it's far more like Trotskyism than it is like Republicanism. And it makes sense, doesn't it? Communism has been overthrown in the Soviet Union and the Russian Federation, and now the new Trotskyites, the neocons, have taken over the policy of the United States government, and now we are torturing people in the dungeons of the old KGB, while Russia has become a force for moderation. In all things, ladies and gentlemen, we are just not getting the entire truth. The next chapter I'm going to deal with is called A Holocaust Inquiry. And I never state flatly there was no, quote, Holocaust. I'm not going to ever be a Holocaust denier. For one thing, there are laws in this world about that. But I can state categorically that there are different opinions, and I believe that different opinions need to be heard. And in this chapter of Jewish supremacism, I will give my own experiences about the Holocaust as a young man, the impressions it had on my life, and I will talk about the Holocaust questioners, and I use that term rather than doubters, and discuss what they say and what they believe and how they shouldn't be imprisoned for simply echoing their opinion. So we're going to begin. This is chapter 12, A Holocaust Inquiry. And I'm going to begin by a quotation by Dr. Norman Finkelstein, a Jewish researcher and author of the book Holocaust Industry, and also author of Chutzpah, The Use and Abuse of Anti-Semitism. And by the way, Dr. Norman Finkelstein is a longtime member of the Jewish community. His parents are, quote, Holocaust survivors, unquote, themselves. So he's certainly no anti-Semite in any way. He has deep roots in the Jewish community. He is completely Jewish himself. But he has had the temerity to talk about some of the fraud that's been associated with what he calls the Holocaust industry. Now, this chapter is not saying at all that there were not atrocities committed against Jews by the Germans in the Second World War. This chapter does talk about some of the issues that have historical questions to them. And it also talks about the extent of the Holocaust, and it talks about the efforts that have been made to suppress any sort of debate on the issue. And I certainly believe that there can be no freedom unless there is open debate. If teachers or educators or politicians or anyone else are afraid to utter any criticisms or any questions about a period of history on the threat of being fired or losing their pensions or even being put into prison, how in the world can we ever come about any truth? And the people that make that kind of oppression, that kind of suppression of free speech, they're the ones who are truly behaving as those they hate, those they claim suppressed freedom of speech and conscience, the Nazis. They're the ones who are truly acting in that manner. So I start with a very powerful quote by Dr. Norman Finkelstein. By the way, Dr. Finkelstein, believes that there was, in fact, quote, a Holocaust and that there are mass murders of Jews. But he's talking about the fact that there certainly has been fraud and nonsense in what is commonly called Holocaust literature. Here's the quote. "Much of the literature on Hitler's final solution is worthless as scholarship. Indeed, the field of Holocaust studies is replete with nonsense, if not sheer fraud. Given the nonsense that's turned out daily by the Holocaust industry, the wonder is that there are so few skeptics." That's Dr. Norman Finkelstein. And I begin. "After I became aware of the ethnocentrism that permeated Judaism and Zionism, and of the pervasive Jewish presence in the media, I read some books and articles that hinted that the stories of German atrocities during the Second World War were exaggerated and misconstrued. Some suggested that the persistent saturation of the media with what is now called the Holocaust, decades after the war, was motivated by the strategic interests of Israel. At first, I rejected the idea that some of the allegations against the Germans could be false, for I had seen the gruesome photos and films that seemed to make German atrocities self-evident. The following is an account of how I came to question some aspects of this somber period of European history. I wrote an essay for an English class at Louisiana State University on the liberalization of American sexual morality. I recounted how I'd never seen a picture of a fully frontal, completely nude woman until I was a freshman in high school. That reminiscence may sound strange to young people today, but even Playboy magazine omitted the most private sexual area until the mid-1960s. After I wrote the essay, a right-wing friend who read it told me that I was mistaken about not seeing full nudity in my childhood. "You have seen fully nude women," he said. "Graphic pictures of nude men and women, often emaciated in horrible scenes of death. You saw many photographs and films of the Jewish victims of Nazi atrocities." On reflection, I had to admit that he was right. Television and print media of the late 1950s and early 60s were much more prudish than they are today. But during the years of my childhood, the media often showed horrific photographs and newsreels depicting graphic scenes of mutilated and emaciated nude Jewish victims of the Second World War. They burdened the pages of magazines such as Look and Life. They never failed to appear in television documentaries on the war, and even daily newspapers reprinted them, including my hometown newspaper, the Times-Picayune. In a time of innocence when my friends and I had never seen a photograph of a completely disrobed woman, the media showed us cadavers, often of nude women, or the small frames of children piled up like so much cordwood being bulldozed by Allied troops into mass graves. Those photographs were powerful. For even today, those images remain vivid, etched deeply by the emotion evoked by them. My friend suggested that there was a political reason why the media repeatedly showed me the Jewish victims of the Second World War. Was it accidental? He asked rhetorically. If it was just for the sensationalism of nudity and death, why are Jewish victims practically the only ones shown? When the movie Faces of Death opened in theaters across America in 1974, millions lined up to see actual film footage of real people in the throes of death. Seeing a human being in the maladroit pose of death is perhaps the most riveting sight a human being can witness. Parents shield their children from such scenes, and television news programs seldom show the most gruesome pictures of a homicide. Despite the media's frequent use of sensationalism to boost ratings, even after the crash of a passenger airliner, they usually show only general footage at the scene rather than the severed heads and torsos. Many voice concern that television programs and movies are too violent and gory for young children, yet the horrific scenes of the Holocaust have now become mandatory viewing for some school children by state law. Jewish groups have lobbied to pass laws to require, quote, Holocaust studies in public schools, and many thousands of local school systems, at Jewish urging, have simply mandated it. The bloody violence of the rankest of fictional movies or television programs could not possibly be more graphic than the gory scenes of the Holocaust. Would those same schools show films of the bloody victims of airline crashes to their young charges? Would they show the massacres of Palestinian women and children butchered at the Sabra and Shatila camps in Israel-occupied Lebanon? Are the victims butchered by the communists in Cambodia? 10 9-year-olds? For what reason, I ask myself, must they show little children these horrible scenes of Jewish victims of a half century ago? Proponents of Holocaust studies for school children say that the trauma is necessary to teach them about the dangers of racism and anti-Semitism. Yet they show no victims with their brains blown out to teach children the horrors of criminal homicide, no scenes of the millions of corpses starved or butchered by the Soviet mass murderers to teach children the dangers of communism. No colleges have a Gulag studies department, and no public high schools require studies about the Gulags to graduate. One of the arguments used by those who promote Holocaust studies for our young children is that the Holocaust shows the evils of racism. It reveals, they say, that mass murder is the ultimate consequence of racial consciousness. They fail to point out that far more human beings have been slaughtered in the name of equality than in the name of racism. From the days of the bloody excesses of the French Revolution to the millions butchered by the Soviets in their gulags, the murderous Red Guards in China, and the killing fields of Cambodia, no doctrine, no philosophy of life or government has killed more people than communism, and at its very heart lies fanatical devotion to egalitarianism. The awful scenes of Jewish suffering and death touched my heart as a young man, and they still do. They spawned revulsion at the inhumanity that produced such horrors. Indeed, it arouses anger in all of us against those responsible for that carnage. Nevertheless, as I became more aware of the early Jewish domination of the international communist movement, I wondered why the media's focus was almost entirely on Jewish suffering, with little attention afforded the other victims of mass murder. The only victims of whom I was really conscious about in my youth were Jews. They were the victims I read about, the victims I saw in television dramas, the victims I saw in the graphic photographs and newsreels. No greater human crime exists than the slaughter of the innocent. British historian David Irving labels it innocenticide. Yet, I eventually learned of an innocenticide far more extensive than even the terrible crimes of the Nazis. This knowledge did not come from television documentaries or docudramas or from well-publicized trials of war criminals or searches for them, but from the quiet pages of books and documents little discussed by the popular media. Communists in Russia, Eastern Europe, and China killed at least 10 times more innocent people than were allegedly killed by the Nazis. As a young teenager, those victims of communism were outside of my awareness. I heard comments about atrocities by the communists, but I saw no newsreels or photographs of the victims of communism. I cannot recall even one. I saw no documentaries, nor did I read any diaries of young girls, or anyone else, for that matter, who had suffered at the hands of the communists. Thus, I had no emotional involvement with the Christian victims of communism, but I had a strong emotional tie to the Jewish victims of the Second World War. Spurred on by my anti-communism, I read about the greatest human slaughter in world history, the murder of tens of millions of Christians in communist Russia. I read with fascination and horror about the horrible murder of Tsar Nicholas and his family by Jewish Bolsheviks, and the mass murders begun by Lenin, and climaxing in the unparalleled slaughter committed by Stalin. Lenin's classic statement about mass murder by the Soviet state illustrated the cold-blooded nature of these killings. He said, quote, "You can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs," unquote. By the early 1960s, published information from the Kremlin itself acknowledged that the early leaders of communism had organized a liquidation by the Communist Party's own estimates of 15 to 25 million people. During this period, the media remained focused on the sufferings of Jews. During this period of revelations, the media remained focused on Jews, with little sympathy or attention showed to the other victims of totalitarianism. I found it amazing that the media lavished so much attention on atrocities against Jews while showing indifference to the mass murder of millions of Christians by Jewish commissars in the Soviet state. The muted response to Soviet atrocities seemed unexplainable considering the fact that at the time America was in a Cold War with the communists. What psychological weapon could have better been used against the communists in that worldwide ideological Cold War than exposing the historical truth of their massacre of tens of millions of human beings? But the Western press kept mostly silent on the Soviet mass murders, even while millions still suffered in communist concentration camps around the world. Millions more died in Red China during the so-called Cultural Revolution, in many nations of Africa, in the jails of Cuba, in the killing fields of Cambodia, and in the re-education camps of Vietnam. Yet, during a period when Marxists liquidated millions, all we seemed to see was the endless parade of stories about Jewish suffering of decades before. At the same moment, Jewish pundits were screaming, "Never again," about atrocities committed by a solitary regime dead and gone for decades. Millions of innocent people faced torture and death in dozens of communist tyrannies around the world. While the murders continued, we heard only a few whispers about them. But the saturation publicity about Jewish suffering in the war goes on to this day. During the late 1960s and early 70s, I attended meetings of the anti-communist Cubans and many Eastern European nationalities who had suffered grievously at the hands of the communists. Latvians, Estonians, Lithuanians, Ukrainians, White Russians, Romanians, Hungarians, Czechs, Poles, Croatians, Serbs, what was Eastern Germans, and many other refugees told a story of oppression and torture and murder that received only a fraction of the media coverage of the Holocaust. Yet their story concerned the major and terrible suffering of even greater numbers of people. While the media trumpeted the search, capture, and trial of German war criminals, modern-day communist war criminals continued incarcerating, torturing, and murdering millions in camps around the world. The Jewish-dominated media made no determined effort to prevent the destruction of lives that might have been saved, nor did they make a righteous call for the prosecution of communist war criminals past or present. After I learned of the great massacres organized by the Jewish Bolsheviks in the Soviet Union, I wondered why I reserved such special rancor for the Nazi perpetrators of war crimes. Why, I wondered, did I reserve special enmity for one mass murderer over another? Whether it is a commissar murdering the Tsar and his children, an SS commander in war-torn Eastern Europe liquidating Jews, a Chinese Maoist Red Guard murdering thousands in the so-called Cultural Revolution, a Jewish member of the Stern Gang massacring Palestinians at Deir Yassin, or an Arab terrorist blowing up a commercial market in Tel Aviv, are not all mass murderers equally depraved? Yet, undeniably, it was for the Jewish victims that I had the most empathy, and for their anti-Semitic persecutors, I had the most disgust and anger. And I asked myself, what brought that on? At that point, I began to understand how I'd been manipulated. Because of Jewish influence in the news and entertainment media, it was their story I saw on television and in the movies. It was their heartbreak I shared in books, their mangled bodies I saw in pictures and films, their horror I heard from teachers and preachers. How powerful is the impact on a 9 or 10-year-old is it when his first scenes of nudity he sees in media are accompanied by horrible scenes of death? I began to ask other politically incorrect questions about the Holocaust. Even if everything the media says about the Holocaust is true, why does it occupy our attention a thousandfold more than the massacre of many more people by the Soviets? Now that communism has fallen, why is there no clamor for Nuremberg-type trials for the communist mass murderers? Another question I have come to ask in the 1990s is, why Are there no war crimes trials for Israel's many mass murderers of Palestinians, such as at Deir Yassin, at Kibya, at Shatila and Sabra, and at Qana? Now, these crimes are documented crimes against humanity, easily proven, and there are many Israeli officials who have already publicly confirmed these crimes against humanity. But no one seems to be interested in bringing Jewish murderers to justice. If suspected German war criminals are the only ones to be targeted, doesn't that suggest an anti-German ethnic bias in itself? Other questions began to plague me. If putting an innocent Jewish civilian in a gas chamber was the epitome of evil, then was the aerial firebombing of millions of German and Japanese civilians morally wrong as well? Is there an ethical distinction between murdering the innocent by poison gas and murdering the innocent by burning them alive? Does it make it morally acceptable that America firebombed civilian women and children because we are at war with the Germans and Japanese? By that standard, would Second World War German atrocities against Jews be somehow acceptable if they considered themselves to be at war with the Jews? I read a book by David Irving called The Destruction of Dresden. It exposed the murderous firebombing of Dresden in the waning days of the Second World War. Most Americans have heard much about the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, but few are aware that more people perished in Dresden than in either of the cities obliterated by atomic bombs. Dresden was an Allied experiment. They wanted to discover if they could create a firestorm by dumping tons of incendiary bombs on the city center. Dresden was a city of priceless artistic and cultural treasure that had been untouched up to that point during the war. The bombing set the entire inner city ablaze, creating hurricane-like winds that fed the flames. Asphalt bubbled and flowed in the streets like lava. When the aerial attack was over, at least 100,000 people had perished. To avoid the spread of disease, the authorities burned the ghastly remains of tens of thousands of people in grotesque funeral pyres. Dresden had no military significance, and when it was bombed, the war was practically won. If anything, the bombing only stiffened German resistance and cost more Allied lives. I sincerely ask myself, was the bombing of Dresden a war crime? Was it a crime against humanity? Were the children who suffered the cruelest death of all being burned alive any less wronged than, say, Anne Frank, who was placed in the concentration camp and ultimately succumbed to disease? Today, the British government admits that their air ministry from February 1942 embarked on a policy of targeting German civilians for bombing. As Barnes Review points out, more than 600,000 men, women, and children perished from bombing calculated to kill as many civilians as possible. The United Nations now defines deliberate bombing of civilians as a crime against humanity. The double standard that seemed to exist in all things dealing with the Second World War nagged at my sense of fair play. An example of the media's morality of convenience is the treatment of the Oklahoma City bombing as compared to the tremendous civilian bombing of the Second World War. I still remember the refrain after the Oklahoma City carnage and the incredulity that echoed in the trial of Timothy McVeigh. In essence, it went, "What kind of monster would bomb and burn to death children?" Is the burning alive of tens of thousands of innocent babies by intentional civilian bombing from planes any less morally wrong than the murder of 24 children by Timothy McVeigh? Governments give one bomber of children medals and another the death penalty. However, the ultimate blame must fall on the governments that institute such policies, not on the soldiers that follow their orders, often bravely. I view the intentional mass murder of women and children by anyone, any cause, or any government as unjustifiable. Even after the war's end, for many months, the Allies allotted an official calorie ration for each German civilian that was less than that could sustain life. The Barnes Review again points out that hundreds of thousands of civilians died in those months of hunger, exposure, and disease. The Soviets forced millions from their homes in German lands in the East. In violation of the Geneva Convention and long-standing rules of war, millions of German soldiers were held long after the war's end, and hundreds of thousands died from starvation, exposure, and illness in the Allied-administered camps. Now, those deaths occurred after the fury of the war had ceased, and while massive stores of food and medicine were close by, stockpiled in Allied warehouses. I found a perfect example of the us-and-them double standard of morality in a book I learned about in college called Germany Must Perish. The book was written by an American Jew, Theodore N. Kaufman. It was published in 1941, before America's involvement in the war and before the allegation of any German extermination program against Jews. The preface states, and I quote, "This dynamic volume outlines a comprehensive plan for the extinction of the German nation and the total eradication from the earth of all her people. Also contained herein is a map illustrating the possible territorial dissection of Germany and the apportionment of her lands." Unquote. Both Time magazine and the New York Times reviewed the book rather than simply dismissing it, and neither publication seemed too outraged at its open call for genocide. How would today's moralists react if the Nazis had published a book called Jews Must Perish, and major magazines and newspapers in pre-war Germany had publicized a book calling for, quote, "the total eradication from the earth of all the Jewish people"? Would not they offer that book and that promotion of the book as proof of the moral depravity of Germany? As a teenager, although I was fiercely patriotic and pro-American, I began to see that in war, no side had a monopoly on virtue. And in total war, in which one side annihilates the political and cultural establishment of the other, that only the victors write the history. The adage that, quote, "in war, truth is the first casualty," applies here. So what of the truth of the Holocaust? I knew that America's mass media had deceived me about the origins and driving force behind Soviet and international communism, and about the extent of communist mass murder. It certainly seemed possible that the Jewish-dominated mass media would be just as deceptive on an issue immensely important to them. By the time I looked into the details of the Holocaust, I had already learned that the media-generated image of the always innocent Jewish religion and people was false. Yet I still found it difficult to look at the Holocaust objectively, for not so many years before, my eyes had misted with tears when I read Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl. I was, and still am, deeply moved by the scenes of human carnage from the Second World War. On the surface, it seemed the evidence of the Holocaust was overwhelming. Mountains of books, magazine and newspaper articles, movies, sermons, speeches, documentaries proclaimed it with nary a word of contradiction. In addition, as a fiercely proud young American with proud military history in my family, I was prone to believe all the war propaganda about my country's enemies. My father, a full colonel who still participated in the Army Active Reserve, viewed his participation in the Second World War as the most meaningful period of his life. He would not hear of any mitigation of German guilt. The Holocaust was part of my father's belief system, and it became part of mine. However, I discovered that a number of distinguished Americans had made statements dissenting somewhat from the establishment version of World War II history, and they included such men as Senator Robert Taft, Charles Lindbergh, General George Patton, and former Supreme Court Chief Justice Harlan Fiske Stone. I read the interesting views of Paul Racinier, a Holocaust survivor who spoke out against what he called the lies of the Holocaust. Racinier was a French political opponent of the Nazis. He suffered greatly during the war. In a number of concentration camps during the war, he never saw any evidence of human gas chambers or any program to exterminate Jews. And after his liberation, he read sensationalized accounts that he knew were false. Although he had little respect for his German captors, he felt it was his ethical duty to tell the truth about the camps and refute the exaggerated and false claims being made in some of the world's press. In addition to the poignant accounts of his own experiences and observations, he began to research the entire issue after the war. Racinier contended that the death toll in the camps was far lower than alleged, and that the camps were primarily caused, deaths in the camps were primarily caused by poor conditions, the unintended effect of the losses and devastation of a nation crushed in a catastrophic war. He also called the allegations of gas chambers, quote, classic examples of war propaganda that had no basis in fact, unquote. Racinier had nothing to gain personally in post-war France by taking such an unpopular position. In fact, he had much to lose. And after suffering all the hardships and privations of the German concentration camps, he then suffered intense persecution for his courageous writings. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of the first part of my chapter entitled A Holocaust Inquiry from my audiobook version of Jewish Supremacism. As you can see, there's lots of interesting aspects of this chapter, and the Holocaust has become central in the world's events. As you know, I am no so-called Holocaust denier. It's, in fact, against the law in many countries of the world. But I do have questions, legitimate questions, about aspects of the so-called official story of the Holocaust. And I go into these questions in this chapter, and I hope that you find them interesting. Tomorrow we'll begin by going into some of the famous victims of the Holocaust, such as Anne Frank, such as Elie Wiesel, such as Mr. Wiesenthal. And interestingly enough, none of the most famous victims, the victims you know by name, none of those victims were in fact put into gas chambers. The most famous victim, of course, is probably Anne Frank, and she died from disease, as well as her sister and mother. Her father survived the war. Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Prize winner and the great, the high priest of the Holocaust today. He was even sick at Auschwitz, and they put him into the hospital for weeks. They did not put him in any gas chamber. And another famous victim, of course, was Simon Wiesenthal, the late Simon Wiesenthal. And Wiesenthal himself committed suicide, or tried to, and the Nazis very carefully nursed him back to health. These stories don't quite mesh with the image of the Holocaust presented in the world's media, do they? Anyway, I'm going to go into those issues and a few more fascinating points in the next broadcast. And I do appreciate your support and your work to spread these ideas around the world and to make sure that we have a free discussion of ideas and principles. There can be no truth without the freedom to question. There can be no truth of history or of science or of religion unless people are unafraid to discuss issues without fear of imprisonment or loss of job or pension or physical coercion. I believe in freedom, and I hope everybody listening to this broadcast has that same opinion. Often it's kind of interesting that the people who are anti-Nazis often cite the fact that the Nazis burned books and that they wanted to stifle certain kinds of dissent in their country. And yet the people who oppose the revisionists in terms of the Holocaust, they are acting in the same fashion of what they condemn in the National Socialists of Germany. Ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate your help, and your help enables me to get this word out around the world. I need your help, and I depend upon it, and the world really depends upon it. Thanks so much for being with me. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow. This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.davidduke.com.